Hello, and welcome to D&D Book Club. My name is Megan, and today is a very special episode. Why is it special? Because this is my one-year anniversary episode. The first ever episode of this podcast aired on this date last year with a deep dive into the Dragonlance novel Dragons of Autumn Twilight by Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman. Since then, we've traveled on dragonback across Kryn, planeswalked through the worlds of Dominaria and Phyrexia, and even been drawn through the mists of Ravenloft. Where will we go this year? Menzoberranzan? Sigil? Ravnica? You'll just have to subscribe to find out. I want to say thank you to all of you who have listened to this podcast over the last 12 months. This little program has been one of the most creatively rewarding endeavors of my life. It's brought back a passion for stories I thought I had lost long ago, and it's introduced me to so many wonderful people in the gaming and podcasting communities. It's even inspired me to start running my own Dungeons & Dragons games and creating my own content. That content, by the way, is available on the DMs Guild. Just click the link in the show notes. As of the publication of this episode, all my DMs Guild content is free to purchase. And if listening to me talk on one podcast isn't enough, check out my guest appearances on the Slovenly Trolls podcast, where Lissa, Chardet, and I discuss the intersection of feminism and fantasy fiction. And don't forget to listen to my guest appearance on the Nothing to Fear podcast, where host Billy and I discuss the Halloween movie franchise. And, if you don't already, go listen to the Dragonlance Canticle podcast at dragonlancenexus.com/podcast. It's a wonderful show where myself and an elite team of Dragonlance nerds discuss all things Kryn. This episode will be our last episode, focusing on everyone's favorite Death Knight, Lord Soth. We've done Lord Soth, Knight of the Black Rose, and Spectre of the Black Rose, and today we are going to wrap things up with a few Lord Soth stories. We will be discussing True Knight by Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman from the Dragonlance Cataclysm Anthology, and we will be discussing Rigor of the Game by James Lowder from the Tales of Ravenloft Anthology. Then we will finish with a special surprise story. Before we go into all that, however, I need to fix a few mistakes I made in the last episode. James Lowder, author of Knight of the Black Rose and co-author of Spectre of the Black Rose, heard my episodes and kindly reached out to me on Facebook to clarify a few points I made. First, I was under the assumption that Spectre of the Black Rose was meant to be the second of a Lord Soth trilogy set in Sithicus, but that the authors deviated from their original plan since TSR/Wizards of the Coast stopped producing Ravenloft novels. As it turns out, Spectre of the Black Rose was always intended to be the second novel of a trilogy. The third novel of the trilogy, which would have been called Wake of the Black Rose, would have been about Sithicus after Soth's departure. If you've ever read the third edition Ravenloft sourcebook material about Sithicus, you can see what that domain would have looked like without Soth. I also learned that, along with the third Black Rose novel, there was also plans to publish the sequel to Vampire of the Mists, presumably a continuation of the tragic love story between Count Strahd von Zarevich and Jander Sunstar. How rad would that have been? Unfortunately, Wizards of the Coast vetoed attempts by the third edition Ravenloft publisher, White Wolf, to publish more novels. James Lowder also informed me that Veronica Whitney Robinson, the co-author of Spectre of the Black Rose, was not assigned to help him finish the novel, as I had assumed. In fact, Lowder reached out to her for help. In his own words, she wrote drafts of a few sections in the second half of the book based on my outline and notes, while I was writing the other chapters. I then revised her draft so the style and tone fit the first half of the book and the later material I was writing. Whitney Robinson then went on to write for Forgotten Realms and Star Wars. So thank you to James Lowder for reaching out to me and giving me a more accurate context. It's truly a thrill to hear from a bona fide D&D author. Now let's jump into the stories. True Knight by Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman appeared in the second Tales trilogy in a collection titled The Cataclysm, published in 1992 by TSR. This anthology is composed of short stories and poems set during or after the earth-shattering event known as the Cataclysm. In case you don't recall, the Cataclysm was a disaster visited upon Kryn by all the gods to restore the balance of good and evil on Kryn by destroying the city of Istar, ruled by the king priest and his disciples, whose influence had corrupted all of the continent of Ancelon. While the church was nominally devoted to the gods of good, their fanatical belief that they were the sole arbiters of good and evil naturally meant that anyone who was not part of their order was, by definition, evil. This attitude led to persecutions, inquisitions, slavery, forced migration, and even genocide. Eventually, the church put the king priest himself on a pedestal with the gods, and he began to believe his own myth-making. He thought he was the equal of the gods and demanded they recognize him as such. So the gods did what any self-respecting deities would do. They dropped a fiery mountain on him. The continent was fractured, countless thousands died, and those who survived faced the horrors of famine, disease, and war. True Night begins 2 weeks prior to the cataclysm, after the Night of Doom, when all the true clerics have been taken to the realms of their respective gods, leaving only the faithless clerics of the King Priest behind. Our two heroes, Lady Nicole and Brother Michael, are two of the only people on Kryn who know what is about to happen. We first meet them in another story called The Silken Threads, which I will cover in another episode. During the events of that story, Brother Michael, a cleric of Mishakal, refuses his chance to go with his goddess to the heavenly realms with the other clerics. He refuses because he is secretly in love with Lady Nicole, the daughter of a Salamnic knight and the twin sister of a Salamnic knight, both deceased. After their adventure in the Silken Thread, the two return to Nicole's ancestral castle. Nicole is despondent following the loss of her twin and the revelation that an unthinkable disaster is, quite literally, hanging over their heads. She decides that, if she is going to die, she wants to die in her family home. Unfortunately, it's been ransacked by goblins. The interior of the house is in a complete shambles with all manner of unmentionable goblin filth strewn about. Nicole and Michael set to work cleaning it up to make it livable and to prepare themselves for the coming doom. As the day of the cataclysm draws nearer, Nicole begins to withdraw further into herself. With no reason to hope for a better future, she retreats from the world. Michael does his best to coax her into remaining with him in the world of the living. He even confesses his love to her, but Nicole is unmoved. It's as if she has given up the will to live altogether. Michael, despite knowing that the gods are about to leave humanity to its fate, prays to Paladine, the favored god of Nicole's family. 9 days before the cataclysm, a visitor appears at their door, a knight of Salamnia, a knight of the Rose. His appearance rouses Nicole. The existential dread of the future may be too much for her to bear, but she is the daughter of a knight, and, in the here and now, the daughter of a knight has certain obligations. She rises from her stupor and dresses herself to receive a guest, as the knight's code of hospitality insists she must. Nicole and Michael go out to greet the knight. Nicole apologizes that she cannot give a more proper welcome, but the visitor doesn't mind. Brother Michael, on the other hand, is wary of this man. He appears haggard and frenzied, as if he's riding to beat the devil, as they say, and carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders, as they also say. Nicole introduces herself and Brother Michael. The knight introduces himself, Lord Soth of Dargard Keep. Nicole, of course, offers him to stay at the castle, but Soth rebuffs her offer. He only asks for water for himself and his horse. He's a man on a mission and needs to continue his journey to Istar. Nicole and Michael are horrified and immediately try to convince Soth not to go there, knowing Istar is about as safe as Pompeii at this point. Soth explains that he too knows what awaits Istar, and he is on a quest to sacrifice his life to prevent it. With that, the brave knight departs. Nicole watches him go. This encounter has awoken something in her, and she vows to honor the legacy of the knighthood in which her father and brother so devoutly believed. Michael knows that Nicole sees in Soth what she wants to see, an ideal of virtue and courage. Michael only sees a man and knows that men can fail. He continues to put his faith in the gods of good and in the strong walls of their home. But Nicole begins to believe that the world may be redeemed after all, pinning all her hopes on Lord Soth. Of course, as we already know, Soth never makes it to Istar. The day of the cataclysm arrives. In Salamnia, far from Istar, Nicole and Michael are outside the blast radius of the Fiery Mountain. Their cataclysm comes in the form of a horrendous storm. Nicole tries to deny the truth of what is happening, to insist that Soth may yet succeed. She prays to Paladine to give Lord Soth the strength to complete his quest, but they are all beyond hope. The storm only builds in fury. Black skies cover the land. Hurricane-force winds buffet the castle with unceasing fury. Lightning rends trees into splinters and sets whole forests ablaze. Earthquakes shake the castle to its foundations. Michael and Nicole huddle together in terror, but he reminds her that soon they will travel to the holy realms of the gods, and all will be well. In time, the storm abates. The castle holds. Nicole and Michael have survived, and more than survived. Nicole has come to realize that she's fallen in love with Michael. The rules on clerical marriage in Dragonlance are a bit murky, probably even murkier when the man getting married is the only priest left on the planet, but Michael seems unconcerned. In their hearts, they are married, and that's what counts. And now that they are married, they start to argue. Nicole is angry with the gods for the devastation they have wrought upon the world. Michael explains that everything happens for a reason, the gods work in mysterious ways, we can't know the divine plan, yada yada, etc., etc. Either way, they have more practical matters to deal with. Their food is running out and the land around the castle can't sustain them. They need to move on. Michael suggests that they travel to Zaxaroth. It's his home city and, more importantly, the location of the platinum discs of Mishakal, which contain the wisdom of the gods. If they can find the discs, he reasons, they can read them and perhaps make sense of this tragedy. Nicole is dubious. They've heard reports from refugees about the state Zaxaroth is in, what with the whole falling off a cliff thing. Nevertheless, they decide to go. Travel through post-apocalyptic Ancelon is treacherous, but eventually they reach Zaxaroth. If you'll remember way back to Dragon's Bottom Twilight, this is where the heroes of the Lance will come 300 years later, when seeking to understand the power of the Blue Crystal Staff. Maybe they should have been called the Heroes of the Staff, since it really plays a bigger role in the events of the war than the Dragonlance does. I guess it's not as catchy, though. Anyway, Zaxaroth is a bust. Only the temple remains standing, and the doors to the Temple of Mishakal are shut and cannot be opened. Michael briefly considers going to the Plainsmen of Abyssinia. His mother was a member of one of the tribes, and they might be safe among her people. Outside the temple, the pair encounters a madwoman whose children have disappeared. Nicole and Michael assume the children must be dead and try to convince the woman to let them take her somewhere safe. She refuses, saying she will wait here for her children to return. She does give them a cryptic clue, however, when they mention the platinum discs. She says the answers they seek can be found in Palanthus. Assuming this means what they think it means, they leave the strange woman, and head north. Too bad they didn't go to Palanthus first. It would have meant a lot less travel. Nicole and Michael eventually reach the city. Palanthus was spared the worst ravages of the Cataclysm, but the very fact of its survival has made it a destination of countless refugees from all parts of Salamnia. The city is overrun with beggars, thieves, and ordinary people looking for someone to blame for all this chaos. A demagogue has emerged, a man claiming to be a former revered son of the Church of Istar. He knows who the people should blame, the gods. They were envious of the king priest and destroyed him for it. The people need to carry on the King Priest's holy mission by destroying all non-humans, all magic users, and all knights of Salamnia. To get the whole process rolling, however, the revered son has decreed destruction for a somewhat less ambitious target, the Great Library of Astinus. The revered son claims, accurately, that Astinus recorded in his chronicle that the King Priest was to blame for the cataclysm, also accurate. He attempts to whip up the mob into burning down the library. It doesn't work. The people aren't quite there yet. So, the revered son retreats to plot and scheme against Astinus and all his fancy book learning. Nicole and Michael overhear a grim story about a knight who attempted to stop the cataclysm and ended up cursed instead. And the name of this knight? You guessed it. Sturm Brightblade. Just kidding, it's Lord Zoth. The pair decides to travel from Palanthus to the High Claris Tower to talk to the knights there, to let them know what's happening in the city, and to convince them to help overthrow this false cleric. Nicole also wants more information about what became of Zoth. Michael warns her that the truth might not be what she hopes for. The road to the tower, which was once a well-traveled thoroughfare, has been wrecked by the cataclysm and is nearly impassable. One night, while they are camping, a nightmarish apparition appears. Lord Zoth, now transformed into a death knight, has been following them, keeping to the shadows where he can travel unseen. Zoth claims that he was not at fault for his own failure. He claims that the gods deceived him into believing his wife was unfaithful so that he would be distracted from his quest, then the gods could blame it all on him instead of taking responsibility. He has been unjustly cursed. Nicole agrees, believing that the gods are vicious and cruel, but Michael knows that the gods are not that unjust, and there must be more to the story. Nicole and Michael reach the tower without Zoth. Nicole is horrified by what she finds there. The knights of Salamnia who remain hide in the fortress like cowards. She explains to them what's happening in the city, but the knights couldn't care less. The persecution of the knights of Salamnia, which would continue for centuries, has already begun. The Palanthians drove the knights out, and the knights are happy to leave the city to its own fate. Nicole pleads with them to help, but instead they attempt to arrest her for wearing the sword and armor of a knight. And who should appear as her guardian angel? Lord Zoth. He defends Nicole and she is able to escape. With nowhere to go, Nicole and Michael return to Palanthus. The city is in chaos as the mob attacks the homes and shops of non-humans in a frenzy of hatred, whipped up by the revered son. The focus of the mob's rage, however, is the Great Library. Fortunately, it's not as easy to get inside as they had hoped. Nicole and Michael, however, have no trouble sneaking in through a window. They meet Astinus, the immortal historian of Kryn, and explain that they have come for the discs of Mishakal, but first they want to help him defend the library. Astinus is rather nonplussed by the whole business, continuing on as if nothing is happening. Lord Soth shows up yet again, this time as Nicole and Michael are reading Astinus' account of the knight's downfall. This document proves the truth, that Soth is a murderer and deserved what he got. Soth again attempts to shift the blame away from himself, but no one is convinced. At last, Astinus opens the doors to the mob. It's a public library, after all, and they are the public. Nicole, sword in hand, stands ready to defend the building alone, like Horatius at the bridge. The mob is temporarily surprised, then attacks. Nicole is struck in the head by a flying rock, but she refuses to yield. As she fights desperately to survive, she sees a strange vision. A beautiful knight in glowing silver, wielding a flaming sword, fighting beside her. Together, Nicole and the mystery knight drive off the crowd, who flee in terror. Once they are gone, the knight vanishes. When it's all over, Nicole tells Michael about the radiant knight who fought beside her. Michael explains that there was no such knight. It was Soth who fought beside her. Soth chose to defend the library so that the records of his deeds would remain, as a lesson for anyone who might read them about the consequences of succumbing to one's inner darkness. And as for the discs of Mishakal, they aren't in the library. Where are they? The temple in Zaxxaroth, of course. It's all been a wild goose chase. Well, maybe not. Astinus explains that they weren't promised the discs, they were promised answers. And ultimately, that's what everyone is searching for. But Nicole and Michael already have the answer. Each other. The secret to all of life's greatest mysteries was, in fact, love. Just like it is in every book ever written and every movie ever made. Nicole and Michael travel all the way back to Aben Sinia, but this time they do what they should have done the first time and meet up with the Plains people. They join the tribe, have children, and live happily ever after. And, as we learn at the very end, one day they will have a great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson among the Quaishu tribe, a young man who will rediscover the truth of the ancient gods. And his name is Sturm Brightblade. Just kidding, it's Riverwind. So what are we to make of this story? It's relatively short, despite my long-winded synopsis, but it's enjoyable. It's better if read with the silken threads, though, since you get to know the characters more. The description of the cataclysm from Nicole and Michael's point of view is quite thrilling either way. Descriptions of the cataclysm tend to focus either on the fiery mountain falling or the suffering of the people after. We don't get too much detailed descriptions in the books of what it was like living through the event itself. In True Night, we experience it for ourselves. I've never been through a cataclysm, but I've experienced minor hurricanes, minor wildfires, and minor earthquakes, and I can't imagine living through an earth-shaking one of all three at the same time. Hopefully, I never will. What I don't like about this story is the back-and-forth travels. They go from Salamnia to Zaxxaroth, back through Salamnia to Palanthas, and then to the High Claris Tower, and then back to Palanthas, and then south to Zaxxaroth yet again. I understand what the authors were trying to do, trying to show Anselm in the immediate aftermath of the cataclysm and set up the connection between Mishakal and the discs and the Quaishu, but it just doesn't make for very interesting reading. The story also never explains how they get to Palanthas in the first place without passing the High Claris Tower, since it's repeatedly emphasized in other books that traveling through the Vingard Pass, which the tower protects, is the only way to get to Palanthas by land. But some of the scenes in Palanthas can be downright disturbing. In our time, we've experienced what can happen when a demagogue manipulates religion while stoking fear and hatred in order to gain more personal power. The people of Palanthas are scared. Their world has been disrupted. They don't know what the future holds. And here comes this man telling them that other people are responsible for all their problems. The guilt doesn't lie with them for allowing the King Priest's mania to enslave the continent while they remain silent. It's the elves' fault, or the magic users' fault, even the gods' fault. Everyone's fault but their own. All they have to do is drive away those others and everything will be fine again. Telling frightened people what they want to hear can be an easy shortcut to power. And, of course, the classic trick of any demagogue is to attack knowledge, represented in this story by the Library of Astinus. The chronicles tell the unvarnished truth about the King Priest. He was an arrogant, narcissistic tyrant who overreached and was punished for it. But the revered son insists this is nothing but lies and slander. The King Priest was a noble, righteous leader who acted for the good of all mankind. His downfall was not because of any mistakes he made. It was a conspiracy orchestrated by the gods themselves. And why should the people believe the revered son instead of a world-renowned expert historian like Asthenes? Because deep down, they want to believe him. It's easier to blame than to look at one's faults, and the revered son asks that of no one. All the revered son asks is that the people believe him when he claims that only he has the truth, only he can be trusted, and anything which disagrees with him is, for lack of a better term, fake news. But let's talk about our heroes. Michael is likable enough as the doubting cleric torn between his goddess and the woman he loves, and I have a special place in my heart for female knights. Nicole is fun as kind of a prototype for the female knights who appear centuries later, like Lyrana, Sarah Dunstan, and Mina, although it's not entirely clear why she suddenly falls in love with Michael. Maybe just because he's there. However, when the novella ends and their story comes to a close, you aren't left clamoring for more. But this is really Lord Soth's story anyway. We've spent a lot of time with Soth over these past three episodes, not to mention all the core Dragonlance novels he's appeared in, but we always see Soth as he'll become, centuries after his death. Or, like in Ado van Belcombe's novel Lord Soth, and during a few flashbacks in the Ravenloft novels, we see him as a mortal man. True Knight is the only glimpse we get of Soth in the time period right after his transformation. You know, in a superhero movie when the hero has just acquired their powers and is trying to figure out how they all work, or when a supervillain is trying to convince themselves they're perfectly justified in robbing and killing, that's kind of where Soth is at. There's one moment in the story I really liked, so I'll read it to you. A chill wind, which blew from the plane of dark and evil magic, tore aside the cloak of the knight who stood upon that plane, allowed the icy blast to penetrate to the center of his empty being. He drew the cloak closer around him, a human gesture made from force of habit, for this ephemeral fabric, spun of memory, would never be sufficient to protect him from death's eternal cold. The knight had not been dead long, and he clung to the small and comforting habits of blessed life, once taken for granted, now, with their loss, bitterly regretted. Soth sometimes forgets that he's no longer human. Wrapping his cloak around himself will never lessen the cold he feels. He will always be cold, and nothing will ever warm him. It's kind of sad, and that simple human gesture really makes us feel sympathetic. You can't read about someone shivering in the cold, no matter how evil they might be, and not wish you could wrap a blanket around them. But, in Soth's case, it doesn't matter. Nothing can be done to ease his suffering, even for a moment. Soth has already undergone his physical transformation, but his emotional transformation is ongoing. Soth hasn't leveled out into the wrathful, brooding Lord of Evil resigned to his fate that he will appear as in Dragons of Spring Dawning. He's trying to find a way to reverse his curse, and he thinks that the discs of Mishakal might hold the key. Failing that, he tries to blame the gods for his predicament, diverting guilt from himself. He seems genuinely moved when he hears Nicole speak about him, about the knight he was, as some paragon of virtue. Soth was a knight, but never a true knight. As any Dragonlance fan knows, knighthood isn't a matter of rank and accoutrement. Nicole is a truer knight than he ever was. But part of Soth still wishes he could be that person she once imagined him to be. Haven't we all wondered what our lives would be like if we lived up to our highest aspirations? At the very end of the story, Soth shows a glimmer of his fading humanity. He asks that his story be told as a warning to others. Soth sacrifices whatever tatters of his reputation might remain in order to spare someone else the same fate. And we have to ask ourselves, if that glimmer was still there and the gods cursed him anyway, maybe there is some truth to Soth's claim that he did not deserve the punishment he received. Before we continue, I would like to remind listeners that anyone who wishes to support this podcast may do so by visiting patreon.com/dandbookclub. That's D-A-N-D-D book club. For $5 a month, you will get access to special bonus episodes. I currently have two bonus episodes available, The Brothers War by Jeff Grubb and The Thram by J. Robert King. Both of these novels are from the Magic the Gathering universe and tell the origin of the multiverse-spanning war between Urza and Yawgmoth. Later this month, September 2021, I will also be adding a new Dragonlance episode featuring The Soul Forge by Margaret Weiss, the story of Raistlin Maegir's early life. If you wish to support the podcast without subscribing, please consider making a one-time donation with PayPal. using the email address dndbookclub@gmail.com. Again, that's D-A-N-D-D bookclub. Now back to the show. The second story we'll be discussing today is Rigor of the Game by James Lowder. For clarification, rigor is spelled R-I-G-O-R, although the astute observer might pick up on the double meaning. It first appeared in the Tales of Ravenloft anthology, edited by Brian Thompson, published in 1994 by TSR. The story takes place in Sithicus, the land of specters, Lord Soth's domain in Ravenloft. Chronologically, it takes place between Knight of the Black Rose and Spectre of the Black Rose. In fact, since Soth appears to be taking an active role in the affairs of his realm, I'd say this is sometime during his first 15 years in Ravenloft. The story is a short one, so I won't spend too much time on it, but it's a fun story, especially since we get to see Lord Soth at a time in his existence that we don't really see in any other books. The central character is Oliver Arkwright, a professional gambler and skilled fighter. He kind of reminds me of Mel Gibson's character from the movie Maverick. Oliver is the kind of man who enjoys the thrill of life on the edge, surviving by his wits and his luck. Oliver has traveled from Gundarak to Sithicus, to a tavern called the Iron Warden, for a special high-stakes dice game. When he arrives at the tavern, his entry is barred. The bouncer informs Oliver that his measly bag of silver is not enough to get him into the game. It's only when Oliver offers a diamond, supposedly won from the Duke of Gundarak himself, that Oliver is allowed to participate. Once inside, Oliver meets Tisiphone, a professional gambler like himself, with whom Oliver has had some dealings in the past. She looks like a pretty young woman, but Oliver knows she is a deadly killer. Tisiphone explains to Oliver that she won the deed to the tavern in a game from a man who inherited it from his father. She is the one who is organizing tonight's event. The game is a variation of craps. Just in case anyone is unaware, craps is a dice-throwing game where players can place a variety of bets on the outcome of dice rolls made by a player designated as the shooter. At the beginning of each round, the shooter rolls the dice. If the shooter rolls a 2, also called snake eyes, a 3, or a 12, they crap out. If the shooter rolls a 7 or 11, this is referred to as a natural. If a shooter craps out or rolls natural, a new round starts. If the shooter rolls a 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, or 10, that becomes the new target number. If the shooter rolls that target number again, the round ends. If the shooter rolls a 7, they crap out. The shooter can roll any number of times before they hit the target number of 7. Sound complicated? It is, but to any Dungeons & Dragons fan, the notions of gambling on a roll of the dice should be familiar. Craps actually has some similarity with combat in Dungeons & Dragons, except in D&D you're trying to hit a 20 while avoiding a 1. However, the real complexity in craps comes with the betting. You can place all kinds of bets on the outcome of dice rolls. You can bet on the shooter to crap out, bet on them to roll a natural, bet on them to make the target, bet on them to miss the target. You can even bet on specific numbers. And I'm just scratching the surface. I usually play craps on the rare occasions that I visit a casino, but I stick to the simple bets. Anyway, the reason I'm going into all this detail is because the Iron Warden actually has special house rules which are different. First, the dice have death's heads instead of ones, so two skulls is a snake eyes. In this game, if a shooter rolls double death's heads at the start of a round, they lose everything to the house. The next house rule is equally strange. If a shooter rolls a natural, that is a 7 or an 11, the dealer, in this case Tisiphone, can kill it by rolling double death's heads, or the shooter can double their win if the dealer matches the shooter's 7 or 11. This isn't how it works in real casinos, obviously. If it were, no one would ever want to be the shooter, because you'd have everything to lose and only a tiny amount to gain. Oliver, being a clever gambler, is well aware of this. He actively avoids being the shooter as often as he can. However, as the game progresses and more players are eliminated, the remaining players must take their turns as the shooter more and more frequently. At last, it's just Oliver playing against the house. He wins his final throw of the dice, but there's a problem. Tisiphone can't cover his final bet. She has nothing of value to match his diamond, except the deed to the Iron Warden itself, which Oliver accepts. Just then, the doors to the tavern open and Lord Soth appears in his blackened and blood-stained armor. He wants to play too. Accompanied by his seneschal, the dwarven werebadger Azrael, Soth enters. Tisiphone, herself a ruthless murderer, has been expecting them, and even she is cowed by their appearance. Unknown to Oliver, this entire setup, the inn, the game, Tisiphone's forfeiture of the deed, has all been a ruse to lure in the most clever, talented, and luckiest gambler in Ravenloft. Lord Soth's wars against the elves of the Iron Hills have been going nowhere, and he believes that a clever, talented, and lucky man might do better than the unimaginative generals he's been sending out to get slaughtered. According to the charter of the Iron Warden Tavern, the tavern Oliver now owns, he must play Lord Soth in a game of dice. And for his wager, Soth bets the chain of office of the position of Warden of the Iron Hills, the commander of Soth's forces against the feral elves of his domain. Soth shoots first and rolls a double death's head. He loses. But Oliver still gets one roll. And with nothing else to wager, Soth offers Oliver his freedom as a prize. Unless Oliver rolls natural, he will be forced to accept the most dangerous job imaginable. Oliver rolls a 7. He's won, but not quite. Since Soth is acting as dealer in this game, he has the opportunity to kill the natural 7. Of course, Soth will roll double death's heads again. He's a cursed being, a specter of death itself. He could never roll anything else. When Soth rolls his double death's head, Oliver will lose. But Oliver interjects. That second roll to kill the natural isn't a rule of the game. It's a house rule of the Iron Warden. And since Oliver is now the owner of the Iron Warden, he gets to set the house rules. He says that there are no kill rules anymore. The game is over. He has won his freedom from Lord Soth. Lord Soth is disappointed. Surely a man clever enough to outsmart him would make a fine commander. But Soth is a man of his word even now. He will honor the rules of the game. Still needing a commander, however, he decides to appoint Tisiphone. She has no choice but to accept. Before they depart, Soth takes Oliver's hand in his. His freezing cold touch chills Oliver's hand to the bone. Soth tells Oliver that he will return once Tisiphone is dead to play him again. When Soth is gone, Oliver realizes to his horror that Soth has imbued Oliver with his curse. Oliver picks up the dice and rolls a double death's head. And again, and again, and again. In time, Soth will return to Oliver and play him again. This time, Oliver will lose. After all, Sithicus is Soth's house, and the house always wins. So that was Rigor of the Game by James Lowder. It's a fun story, like I said. I especially like the tragic twist at the very end, when Oliver wins the game only to lose in the end. It's perfectly in keeping with the tone of Ravenloft, where any victory against the forces of evil is temporary at best. My only complaint with the story is that it's so short. I think the idea of a cursed gambler traveling through the Land of the Mist is perfect fodder for a novel of its own. This is just pure speculation on my part, but it would be cool if Oliver managed to escape his arrangement with Soth and perhaps reappeared as a character in the unwritten Wake of the Black Rose. I think that if I find myself as a player in another Ravenloft game, I might use him for inspiration. One more point I'd like to make about this story. I love the way that the elves of the Iron Hills are described in this story. Elves are actually pretty rare in Ravenloft. Sithicus is the only domain with a sizable elven population, and this is partially a feature of Lord Soth's torment, that he is forced to constantly be reminded of his murdered elven wife and half-elven son. But the elves of the Iron Hills are in a league of their own, unlike the more settled elves of Sithicus. Here is how Tisiphone describes them to Oliver. They're monstrous things, feral and bloodthirsty. The tortures they use are more horrible than anything you could dream up. She shuddered and took a long swallow of wine. More horrible than anything I could dream up. That description is downright frightening. We all imagine the Lolth-worshipping drow as the epitome of evil elves, but they seem tame by comparison to the wild elves of Sithicus. And now we will move on to our last story. Here is your spoiler alert. If you haven't read any Dragonlance novels after Dragons of Summer Flame and don't want the War of Souls trilogy spoiled, stop listening now. Go back and read the trilogy, then listen to this section again. Okay, if you've read the trilogy and you don't care about spoilers, here we go. This story is not actually its own story. Rather, it's a single chapter from the Dragonlance novel Dragons of a Vanished Moon by Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman. It's the story of Soth's ultimate demise. The famous Kender, Tasselhoff Burfoot, has become unstuck in time. The magical device of time journeying he acquired in the Dragonlance Legends trilogy is bouncing him around through time and space as the wizard Vrais Lemagier tries to use Tass to fix the broken timeline. 19 years before Loki, I might add. One particular jaunt takes him to Dargard Keep, the home of Lord Soth. If you remember our last episode, Soth has returned to Kryn after spending a few decades trapped in Ravenloft, although the veracity of that depends on who considers what to be canon. Perhaps Soth never left at all, and he's just been chilling here since end of Test of the Twins. It's not quite relevant for our little tale, so we will put it aside. Tass encounters Lord Soth at Dargard Keep, and Soth is taken aback. He knows that Tasselhoff was supposed to have died at the end of the Fourth Age, yet here he is. There's something different about Soth, though. For one thing, he's alone. At the end of the Fourth Age, when T'Kesis stole Kryn from the other gods, the Banshees and the Skeletal Warriors went wherever dead things go. Soth remained on Kryn. T'Kesis thought to use him again, but, as she recuperated from the grandest of all grand larcenies, she left Soth alone. For the first time in more than 300 years, Soth didn't have T'Kesis whispering in his ear, filling his heart with malice. And all this privacy has given him time to think. He's come to realize that a lot of the decisions that he made that led to his damnations weren't made out of pride or anger or lust, as the storytellers have always told it, but out of fear. Despite all his pretense at being bold and chivalrous, he was a coward at heart. He always chose the easier option because he feared he would fail. He never let himself show vulnerability for fear what others might think. In a sense, Soth confused manliness with that kind of cheap bravado we now call toxic masculinity. I think the same is probably true for most men who murder their wives. Just then, Mina appears. She is the disciple of T'Kesis, whom Mina refers to as the One God, and is the leader of the Knights of Naraka fighting to conquer Ancelon for the Dark Queen. Mina isn't serving T'Kesis for her own enrichment like Kitiara. She's not even serving her for glory and honor like Ariakan. She is a true believer in every sense, and evil as Joan of Arc. Fortunately for Tasselhoff, he's whisked out of danger just as Mina confronts Soth. Mina offers Soth a job. He will command the Army of the Dead for the One God during the final assault against the continent. When the war is won, Mina will rule the living and Soth will rule the dead, with only the Dark Queen herself above them. Soth politely declines. T'Kesis offered to free his soul if he would serve her during the War of the Lance, but after she was defeated, she reneged on her promise. Soth knows she will do the same again, no matter how well he serves her. She will do the same to Mina, and he tells her as much, although she refuses to believe him. Soth goes to the place where his wife died. He falls on his knees and begs for forgiveness from the spirits of all those he wronged. Mina says that unless he accepts her offer, he will be sent to a place of eternal torment. But Soth is no longer the coward he once was. He would rather eternal torment, considering that a fate well-deserved, than to serve the Dark Queen. In a final attempt to lure him to her side, T'Kesis restores Soth's mortality. He is human once again. Mina uses her power to bring Dargard Keep crashing down around him. But Soth refuses to cry out to the Dark Queen to save him. He is crushed to death by the falling ceiling. In his last moments, he hopes that, in the world beyond, he can somehow find redemption. Thus ends the tale of Lord Soth, Knight of the Black Rose. In the end, what are we to make of Lord Soth? It's hard to be sure. His story has been written by 5 different authors. Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman may have created him, but James Lowder, Veronica Whitney Robinson, and Ado Van Balcom have all added to his mythos, not to mention Lisa Smedman, who wrote When Black Roses Bloom, the Lord Soth module for 2nd edition Ravenloft. Every time an author contributes to a character's story, the portrayal is naturally influenced by the way they understand him, and Soth is such a complex character that everyone can understand him differently. Ado Van Balcom, in his Lord Soth origin novel, portrays Soth as a man who was rotten to the core from the very beginning. His actions were just the culmination of the darkness that had always existed within him. Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman originally portray Soth as kind of a tragic figure, an honorable man who gave in to his worst impulses and was damned for it. Yet, at the very end, he has become introspective. He made the decision that led to his downfall, but it was the Dark Queen who kept him enslaved by hatred. Once he was free from her, he could remember the honorable man he had once been, and at last find the strength to turn away from evil. James Lowder portrays Soth as a man lost to himself. He is a man forever looking backwards, a prisoner of his memories, caught in this inescapable cycle of regret and violence. I've tried over these last episodes to tell you Lord Soth's story, but his story is different for every reader. Whether he's irredeemably evil, a victim of forces beyond his control, or an honorable man who just lost his way depends on you. Do you believe that even the worst people could be redeemed if they had 300 years to think about what they had done? What if an evil person can't be redeemed, not by a lack of desire, but simply because they are caught in the same web over and over again? Here is how I would tell the story of Lord Soth. When Soth refused to save a soul during the Cataclysm, he chose his own fate, and he would continue to choose it over and over again. I don't blame the elven women for telling him his wife had been unfaithful and diverting him from Istar. I don't blame Isolde for calling out the curse that transformed him into a Death Knight. I don't even blame T'Kesis or the dark powers of Ravenloft for stoking that cold fire within him. Soth had many chances to turn away from evil, and every time he chose evil again, right until the very end. Perhaps it was his solitude in the Fifth Age of Kryn, or maybe it was his time in Sithicus that gave him a new perspective after centuries of staring inward. But when Mina offered him the chance to choose evil once again, he finally refused. For the first time in his existence, Soth saw past himself and saw the suffering of all those he had harmed, and he chose to ask for forgiveness. I think I'll stop there. I think I've said all I needed to say about Lord Soth, although I could probably keep rambling on for a few more hours if I wanted to. He will always be one of my favorite characters in fantasy. He simply has a hold on my imagination like few others. I hope you've enjoyed this series on Lord Soth. Before we say goodbye for now, don't forget to listen to my guest appearance on the Slovenly Trolls podcast and on the Nothing to Fear podcast. And please check out my content on the DM's Guild by clicking on the link in the show notes. If you want to support this podcast and hear bonus episodes, please become a patron subscriber by visiting patreon.com/dndbookclub. You can make a one-time donation through PayPal using the email dndbookclub@gmail.com if you prefer. Thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, we are all human, we all have flaws, there is no such thing as a true knight. We are only as great as the greatness we inspire within others. Thank you.